It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Alaska Tracks is on the air. Hi, I'm Randy Zarnke, your host for this special program, where we listen to excerpts from interviews I've recorded with veteran hunters and fishermen and trappers and pilots. These experts share some of their favorite incidents and the knowledge they gained over the years in the great Alaskan outdoors. Today's featured guest is Ken Fanning of Yakutat. Ken actually got his start here in Fairbanks, but then moved to Yakutat for a very specific reason, which you'll learn about later. In addition to being an avid hunter and trapper, Ken became a hunting and fishing guide. He also defended the rights of Alaskan outdoorsmen in our nation's capital during the infamous D2 battles of the late 1970s. Let's listen to this great storyteller as he reflects back on his life.
And I ran the trap line that way that winter, and about that time is when old Jimmy Carter did that monument declaration that closed the ends of acres of Alaska off to hunting and trapping. And that's when we started the statewide organization. By that time, the Trappers Association had been rolling for several years, obviously. I'd stayed highly involved in that. So then, I'm running my dogs and trapping, and we get involved, and it's obvious that I got to go to Washington, D.C. We rounded up all the groups in Alaska and got an organization going to try to slow down this takeover of lands that were stopping hunting and trapping.
What was the name of that organization that you formed to go back?
Oh, that was the Real Alaska Coalition. Yeah, and what the Real Alaska Coalition was it was a consortium of all the outdoor organizations in Alaska at the time, the Alaska Outdoor Council, plus all the various National Rifle Association shooting clubs around the state, and the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, you know, just several sportsmen groups. In March of 1979, the Real Alaska Coalition hosted 11 members of Congress to a trapper's feed out at the TVSA clubhouse that had dog sled rides and so forth. That's Don Young and his wife Lou, and there's Pete Buse's wife serving, and we had King Crab Legs and a big feed, and Congressman John Dingell and John Breaux, and who is today one of the top ranked Democratic senators, and we took them all on dog sled rides. This was one of the sponsors of the bill that the Alaskans supported, Huckabee.
The purpose here was to bring these folks up and convince them of the...
Bring them up and convince them of the importance of a wilderness lifestyle, and that trap lines and log cabins and dog teams really belonged in all these areas, and that the traditional lifestyles that Alaskans held that included those things should not be precluded from any of these new things that they were creating, whether it was parks or forests. You know, and this kind of trip, there were lots of arguments, for example, over trails. And so we took them on a dog sled and showed them why even in interior Alaska, where it's not all that brushy, it's necessary to be able to use chainsaws and brush trails. And that came out in several different pieces of legislation. And we were able to show them what trappers' cabins were like. And by doing it in the middle of winter, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that you wanted to be able to have some place that you could heat up. And most people visit Alaska, as you know, in the summer, but Alaska opens up to trappers in the wintertime when you've got a snow cover and you've got frozen lakes and frozen rivers and you're not causing any kind of environmental damage, and at the same time it's 30 below, so you obviously need a shelter. You don't need a pup tent to skin your fur in and to stay warm for the night. So yeah, that's what we did. We showed them those things. And there ended up being several concessions in the law that allowed a lot of those activities to continue in areas where they were normally and previously prohibited in the United States. Of course, now it's 30 years later and the bureaucracy has cranked down and regulated to death to where it's considerably more of a struggle, and in many instances those kinds of things have been precluded by one sort of regulation or another, which we're all convinced are in violation of the law, but slowly erodes, and we're really glad that we did get some of the protections in the bill. And there definitely is trapping and access and shelter building and cabin building allowed that would not have been otherwise. So that's what we did as the Trappers Association on that particular trip.
So it was a success?
It was not a success. We got our ass whooped. We got a couple of concessions, but from my own standpoint, that's what happened to me, is I worked hard on that with the National Rifle Association, all the organizations in Alaska, and like I say, we made a few inroads. But the D2 bill was such a comprehensive thing, and it really did end up locking up a lot of Alaska, putting a lot of area off limit to hunting and fishing. Working on the outside of it there in Washington, even though we were working with some real credible nationwide organizations, I mean, it just seemed obvious to me that we got whooped pretty bad. But we had a Democratic president, Carter was president, Udall was running the House, so we weren't making very many gains in inroads. roads. The bill is certainly a lot better than it would have been had we had no influence. But that's where I learned my lesson, that from the outside, you don't have much influence on political decisions. So after that experience is when I decided to run for the legislature and get involved in politics. As you probably know, ran and got elected in 1980 to the Alaska legislature, and that's what taught me that you don't have much influence on politics from the inside. So I made the wisest decision in my life, and with a couple of minor exceptions of getting involved in things or helping out for a year or two here and there, why I've left that political arena after just 4 or 5 years of indulgence. I've just been hunting and fishing and trapping ever since, and that was, say, the smartest decision of my life, next to picking the gal that I did.
Tell us a little bit about your guiding operation in the Alaska Range.
Well, I've always loved sheep hunting, and I've got just an incredible area. In fact, as I was an assistant guide, and as I was trapping, and as I was starting my fishing operations, I really explored a lot of places in Alaska and worked with lots of different other folks that were in the business, some good, some bad, all with different types of operations, and got a real feel for what I wanted to do and what the clients wanted and needed and what you ought to promise them and what you ought not promise them. So I had worked for Bob Elliott, and there were some areas that he wouldn't go to because they were too far and too rugged, and so I enjoyed those areas, and that's where we found most of the sheep. You know, I've always felt that adult sheep was one of the most majestic animals in Alaska. Besides being beautiful, they hang around and have the most incredible vistas in the world, and also they're a pretty good challenge. They got a pretty keen sense of smell and hearing and eyesight particularly. So we found this area at the headwaters of the East Fork of the Little Delta up in the base of Mount Deborah and Mount Hess and Mount Hayes. All three of those mountains are directly above us. And in that operation and in this operation, we've been in those same locations now ever since 1974. So I guess that's just about 30 years, but I've found those places and their home. And, you know, there are a few things that give me more of a thrill than coming over the top of a mountain and looking down on a big, beautiful Dall Ram. I just always have enjoyed that. Obviously, I slow down now and personally don't guide as many of the sheep hunts as I used to, but I still do get up and go to all the camps and get on a hunt or two. They'd find an easy one for me. I don't go on the 15, 20-mile cross-glacier treks that I used to quite as often. I threw my back out it. 6 years ago, I had a client, and we went up the face of the Gillam Glacier and camped all night. Almost got these rams, beautiful ram, and then the fog came in. Funny deal, fog came from the bottom, and we had a heck of a time getting off the hill there and made it back to camp and got a ram the next day, and we were just about an 8 mile hike back to the airstrip where the guy was going to pick me up. And this particular hunter was young and in good shape, and man, it had just been a while since I'd packed such a good load across the glacier crevices there, and it had me bogged down pretty good. And so I just sent him on ahead, and I was kind of struggling, sometimes even down on my hands and knees. Anyway, I slipped and fell into a crevasse, wang two of my vertebrae real bad, and you know, you couldn't very well leave the sheep horns in the bottom of a crevasse or the meat. So I just crawled up out of that thing and crawled on down. It was only about 3 miles down to camp. I couldn't stand up. And then that winter we were able to get those two herniated discs shaved off and fixed, and the doctors did a really good job, and I don't have any problem with it, but I don't put 200-pound brown bear that I didn't do a very good job flushing, or 100-pound moose quarters, or 60 pounds of sheep meat on my back anymore. I can still go everywhere, but I just got a little smarter about what we pack, I guess.
You mentioned your operation here, and here refers to Yakutat. Why don't you tell us about this and maybe some of your favorite memories of events down here?
I came to Yakutat because I was looking for a brown bear area, and as I may have mentioned, I'd hunted up in the Brooks Range, I hunted grizzly, and then I'd hunted brown bear on the peninsula and also on Kodiak Island. In the Alaska Range, one of the disadvantages we have is airplanes flying all over the place, and so I wanted to seek some place in Alaska where I could kind of get away from airplane traffic and really know that I was dealing with fair chase hunting and not worried about competition from aerial enthusiasts. So I had a fishing game friend that told me they were having trouble walking the salmon streams down here, counting them, because there were too many brown bear. And when I came here, there were more bears each year killed in defense of life or property in Yakutat than there were taken by port hunters. So I came down, took one look at it, and sure enough, it was just the most adrenaline-pumping, mind-tingling, thrilling hunt I'd ever been involved with. What this really is it's a tropical rainforest without the tropics. It's just a jungle. Most places you can't see more than 10 or 15 feet in the woods. The streams are just teeming with fish, and that's probably the only thing in my trapping and in all of my hunting activities that I suspect that I do considerably different than other guides do and than other trappers do. And that's the way we hunt brown bear down here. And I don't talk about it very much, and I'm not going to talk about it a whole lot now, and I'm not sure why I don't. I mean, it's just one of those things, you know, you're doing different than everybody else, and it seems to be working, and it gives you one of the greatest thrills in your life, and that is floating streams. And we've worked on and developed ways to float very quietly, and we get very close to brown bear. Everybody hears about and reads about different brown bear encounters, and everybody has their own opinions on all that stuff. The only ones I have are my own experiences, and we have lots of them, and we've been charged probably 500 or 600 times times and never had a problem. And when I say never had a problem, I mean that we've never been chomped upon. And we've had a couple instances where bears tried to do that. Lots of times where bears acted like they were trying to do that. I run 8 brown bear hunts in the fall on the salmon streams, and it would be real unusual if we don't get in 10 or 15 situations of bears closer than 5 to 10 yards. Bears in the raft with us is not unheard of. Bears pushing on your shoulders with their noses is not unheard of. Standing on top of log jams with bears walking 5 to 6 inches under you is not unheard of. I'm quite confident that we deal a lot closer to brown bears than most people do. Our average shot is 10 to 15 yards. A 40-yard shot on the river is an extremely long shot. And at the same time, we've never had to kill a sow with cubs, and we've never lost a client, never lost a guide. We've just had a lot of fun doing it. And it's absolutely hair-raising, and it's one of these deals where you're eating, sleeping, drinking, thinking brown bear all the time. If one's not in your view, you can smell him. If you can't smell him or see him, there's a dead fish on the shore with blood oozing out the side where the bear just got done chomping on him. So it's a real exciting type of hunt, and really has given me an awful lot of respect for brown bears and their intelligence. And we work real hard not to do things that would offend them, and they're certainly a wild animal, and we get close, but we don't ever get careless, never. None of our rifles have slings on them. A gun belongs in your hand, and your finger's supposed to be on the trigger 100% of the time, and that's the way we hunt. We're certainly not trigger happy, but we've just never had a situation that didn't work out right. Now, we've had to kill a charging bear one last year, and in fact, one last year was the closest one we've ever had that was in the raft and turned the raft upside down and ate the raft, and the guide and hunter both were in the raft, and that was a sow with cub situation, and that's the first time in 30 years that's happened. Prior to that, I held the record of closeness with a wounded bear that came at us, and I dropped him at a little less than 10 feet. Well, I could touch his nose with the rifle. And Ronnie had one. Ron's my head guide, been with me 23 years or more, and he was borrowing my pack and my spotting scope. They had watched this bear a mile or two away. This was in the spring, and then the bear came up on him up the draw, and anyway, that bear was about 4 feet when they dropped him, but he was a good pickle bear, and the hunter wanted him, so, you know, that worked out right. I generally find that brown bear here have lots to eat, and they got all the salmon in the world. They just really don't want to mess with humans unless you violate those certain circumstances that we all know about. You don't want to get between a sow and cubs. You don't want to get between a bear and its food that it's eating on. You don't want to surprise them. And we've managed to do all three of those on a real regular basis and still not end up with problems. So it really is one of the most tense and exciting kind of hunts to this day. So sheep hunting and brown bear hunting are my favorite. I still do goat hunts, and we do moose hunts, occasionally caribou hunts and grizzly hunts, but the greatest thrills I have now are the brown bear hunts, because I personally spend more time on the brown bear hunts. Over the years, the brown bear hunts and sheep hunts have been my favorite. On the trap line, just the constant thrill as you're going down the trail, either on a dog team or on a snow machine, you know where your sets are and you know what you're hoping for, and then, you know, your blood just boils. When the wolf pack hits the trail and you're counting the miles or the inches to the feet or the yards to where you know your next set is, and that old sharp son of a gun turned off a half mile before you got there, you know, and the silly bastard got back on half mile afterwards, and those are moments that individuals experience personally. And I think with me and the brown bear, it's kind of that deal where I experience them personally. My other guides and hunters tell some pretty good dramatic stories, and I just enjoy it.
Those are some pretty amazing stories from Ken Fanning of Yakutat. We'll come back for more, but right now we have to go to a commercial break. Our fine sponsors support this program. I hope that you will support them in return. Now let's get back to our interview with Ken Fanning of Yakutat. In this next segment, he shares more tales from his amazing career.
Obviously, one of the major facets of your operation here is the fishing. I don't know if you care to go back to what the circumstances were like on the Gulkana, maybe a little bit of time on that, but then tell us a little bit about your fishing operation here in Yakutat.
One of the problems that every outdoorsman faces and a trapper faces is that trapping season isn't year-round, and you want to be doing something year-round. I was running a fishing operation down in the Gulkana for king salmon and sockeye salmon, and then we'd float from Paxson Lake down, and I had camps on the Gulkana River, and you can do that without any strenuous state requirements from a guiding standpoint. And you enjoyed it, and it was a way to supplement your income for a month or two or three in the summertime, and we had a good operation there, and we really enjoyed it. But then when they put that pipeline across in 74, I don't think it had anything to do negative to the resource whatsoever, but it really screwed up my view of Mount Drum as I was coming around that last corner, bringing folks back down the river. So I ran my boat under that thing once and said I'm never going to do that again, and I didn't. So that's when I moved the fishing operation down here to Yakutat, and it's turned out to be the most time-consuming of our operations, financially the most successful of our operations, and the one that you can handle the most folks at. trapping operation, pretty much a solo deal, and hunt guide business, the way we do it, it's always one on one or two on one. In my instance, that means two guides and a hunter, or one guide and a hunter, and never more than that. The way that I like to hunt and enjoy Alaska with people, it's a one on one deal in the hunting business. In the fishing business, it can be a lot different, and down here in Yakutat is the only place in the state that I know of that we have a real active super fishing for in excess of 6 months a year. It's not a short season. We start with steelhead in April and May, and we have the finest steelhead fishing probably on the planet. And then, of course, the halibut fishing and king salmon fishing in the ocean is good even that early. And then throughout the summer, we have all different species of salmon that show up in both the ocean and up the rivers. We do a lot of freshwater fishing for sockeye salmon and king salmon and dollies and rainbows as well in between the runs. Right now there's a bunch of pink salmon in the river, and then the silvers are just now starting in. And our silver salmon season lasts quite a bit later here, actually until mid-October or late October. And there's another steelhead run that takes place in November. Turns out that I'm getting to be such a lightweight now that whereas when we first got down here and were trying to get the operation going, we kept wanting to extend the seasons. Now, by the end of September, we're all saying, shut this son of a bitch off. I mean, we're just had it because it's quite a circus. After living in Fairbanks for 20 years, this was like moving to the tropics. Yakutat receives an awful lot of rainfall, 160 to 180 inches a year, and compared to Fairbanks, less than 10 inches a year. So there are a lot of differences. And it really is tough to trap down here. We tried it a few years, I did, and my son did, and Ronnie, my head guide, did, mostly marten trapping, but today you're dealing with bare ground, and tomorrow you got 6 foot of wet snow, and the next day you're frozen, and so it just requires an awful lot of different types of equipment, and it's just not economically justifiable, but it's certainly justifiable from an enjoyment standpoint. So today our fishing operation is very good. It's still a family operation, but we do have 30 to 35 employees now, and we have 5 river guides and 4 of these ocean boats that can handle up to 6 people and 3 airplanes. So we do, you know, have a pretty full service lodge. It's not fancy by any means, but it's where folks that want to step off a jet and be in wilderness Alaska and see bald eagles and brown bears and moose and catch a lot of fish, enjoy Alaskan hospitality, can do so pretty reasonably compared to the prices that it costs just to access areas that have comparable types of fishing in Alaska. So it's by far our busiest deal now, and we deal with an average of 30 to 60 clients a night throughout the spring and summer. And in the real peak seasons, we'll get up to 70 or 80 or 90. So it's busy. And some of our peak hunting seasons are going on at the same time. It was the hunting business that got me to Yakutat and that we started, and the hunting business is by far my personal favorite. But the fishing business pays all the bills. The trapping business provided all the funds and never did pay all the bills.
Well, we kind of glanced over what I would like you to focus on now, and that is maybe some individual experience, like one particularly memorable sheep hunt, one particularly memorable bear hunt, who you were with and where it was.
I just really have a problem with that, not because I haven't had any, because I've had a lot. And it's hard for me to find experiences like that stand out as the most memorable. All the time relate specific things that happened on a hunt. In the early years, now I'm getting so damn lazy that since 97, I guess I haven't done a very good job. But prior to 97, I wrote a story about every hunt and printed a newsletter every year, fairly comprehensive, 30 to 50 page newsletters every year. Now I just kind of don't do that because the clientele just comes automatically. I don't have to do anything for it. It just happens. One advantage of getting old is everybody knows you, and everybody that went hunting with you has got kids that need to go hunting. You know, I'm not sure that I could do that. I mean, I can think of a specific moment in different hunts. Most of those stories I would tell would be on my own stupidity. You know, I've done a lot of things and had specific instances that show your own weaknesses or make you realize how you really aren't paying attention to things. One of the things that I've had happen on goat hunts, on sheep hunts, and mostly on bear hunts. You know, in life, you never know how different people are going to react to emergency situations or situations that really absolutely require the coolest of thought and the quickest of thought. And I'm talking about things like, you know, when your tent's burning down or the brown bear's about to eat you or you're about to die because you're about to fall off a cliff or you step over a log. That was one of my dandies. I had a little short wheelbase hunter one time, and he was from the Smithsonian, and he wanted a glacier bear, and he also kind of wanted a black bear. So that particular year, we had a lot of snow, and we couldn't get to the place I wanted to early in the hunt till we had a bunch more rain and knocked the snow down. And we had to go in a back way over 8 or 10 miles of trail that hadn't been cleared for 60 or 80 years. I got fairly long legs, and so I could step over most of these damn logs, and this guy couldn't, and so he'd have to go around them, fighting through the brush. And every time we come over a down log, well, I'd step over it, and he'd scoot around the end, you know, and so he'd have to go 50 yards for my step. And anyway, he gets a little upset about that and starts ragging on me, thinking I'm doing this on purpose. Well, of course, I'm not doing it on purpose. So I start walking around the ends of the logs, even logs that I knew I could step over, just to appease him and make sure that he knew that I wasn't trying to pull some kind of guide trick on him and wear him out. It was a pretty long, arduous grind. We had pretty big packs. He finally comes and says, okay, you're just doing this for me. You don't have to do that. If you can step over him, you go ahead and step over him, and I'll crawl over him. I said, okay. He looked at the log in front of us and decided to go around it. I stepped over it and stepped exactly on the back of a brown bear sleeping flat in the trail. I'm telling you, business picks right up when you do that. Things may be kind of boring and slow and down. You step on a brown bear and by God, the world just comes unglued. I mean, I don't have any idea how far up in the air I flew. I don't have any idea how far up in the air the brown bear flew. But he flew up and in the direction of where the hunter was going around the log. So now not only am I wearing this guy out by stepping over logs that he can't, I'm flushing bears to chase him down. Of course, the poor bear was more scared than any of the rest of us, but that was a pretty interesting experience. And I get the giggles. You know, we all have different reactions in these tense situations. And I've seen a lot of hunters that freeze and can't shoot. I've had guys try to put chapstick in their gun instead of bullets. I've had guys that have loaded and unloaded their guns without knowing that they didn't fire a shot. I've had guys drop their rifles in the river. I've had guys run. I've had guys pee their britches. But my personal reaction, and if you're ever with me in the woods and I have the giggles, then by God, we're in a tense situation. If I've got a hunter up on a sheep hunt hanging off a 1,000-foot cliff on a piece of nylon parachute cord and it's over a rough edge and the cord's fraying and the hunter's swinging down there, I get the giggles. And if I've got a brown bear walking underneath me, I just get the giggles. So when I get the giggles, look out, because somebody's about to die or business is about to pick up. But that's one of the things that being in the wilderness and getting in these life-threatening situations, most of them are pickles that I've put myself in over the years. Somehow we've been fortunate enough with the good graces of nature and God and everybody else to get out of all those without too much damage. And I broke a foot on a sheep hunt once. That was another real smart one. I was climbing up in this canyon to get this sheep. It took us about 2 hours to get up and shoot the sheep, and then it took me 13 hours to get to the sheep where the son of a bitch fell. And he was in a real steep chute, and I'm climbing up, and I get a hold of him, and I've got to drag him down. I don't know how I'm going to get over this straight waterfall deal. A hunter couldn't come anywhere near there. And anyway, I lodged a rock loose and scampered down below the sheep in the rock, and the rock rolled down right on my foot, broke my foot. So now I got a sheep, and I get to crawl down to this little waterfall thing, which was quite a ways, actually. The hunter had gotten the assistant guide by then, so they watched, and I pitched the sheep up over the waterfall, and they had to go get climbing ropes and get back up and get me and hoist me down out of that thing. But I really just haven't had any bad injuries. You know, every plane wreck that I've ever been in, we might have had a long walk, but we never had anything else other than that. And the same is true every time I've sunk a boat or got washed ashore, smashed into an iceberg and cracked the boat, and the boat sinks, and then you got to swim a little bit, and then you got to walk a lot. We always complained about them at the time, and we always kicked ourselves in the butt for being so stupid to cause that walk, whether it was from a snow machine engine we couldn't start or a boat that we sunk or whatever. But I remember every one of those, and every one of them were enjoyable hikes. You know, they were under sometimes stressful conditions, and they were almost always along routes that I would otherwise have never hiked. And so I never regretted hiking those places because I would have never done it. I'll tell you one more story, and then I'll show you the remnants of it when we get back to the lodge. I guess in about 76, I had Jack Jonas from Jonas Brothers Taxidermy up here on a spring bear hunt. He and an elderly gentleman from Boston. Jack was from Denver, Colorado. Jonas Brothers years ago was a really famous taxidermist, the first guys that really started it from Europe and brought it over. In fact, that moose that's in our lodge was the first one that Joe Jonas Sr., who had come over from Europe, mounted. And that moose was taken in one of my camps in the Alaska Range way before I took it. That mount is over 60 years old, so the mount's older than I am. But anyway, that's an Alaska Range moose. Anyway, so Jack and I and his buddy were on this hunt, had an assistant guide, and it was raining cats and dogs like it frequently does here, wind blowing, fog down. And we're at this camp. We're across the lake in a little jet boat and a camp at the face of a glacier, so it's a cold, wet, miserable place. you know, we're needing better weather, we just can't see. And fog's down, it's raining that day, and so we get up and I decide we ought to hike up the valley about 2 or 3 miles, and there's a place there where it had been a landslide. And you climb up about 300 feet onto a little ledge, and then you can look way on up the upper valley. But the fog and rain were down, and it had been raining an awful lot, and I wasn't sure that we were going to be able to see, but I figured we might as well go up there. So we did, climbed up there, all four of us, and sat there for an hour in the rain and cold, and you couldn't see 50 yards, so everybody's freezing and wanting to get back. So I told those guys to go ahead with the assistant guide and just walk along the top of the ledge, which would save them about a mile, and then drop down to the creek, go on back to camp, and then I was just going to sit there for an hour or two and see if it had lift, and I really wanted to see if I could cut a track back up in that valley. And so they bailed off, and I sat there for an hour or two and just pouring down rain, and you're huddled there in your little Helly Hansen parka, you know, and you're freezing, and it's getting late enough in the afternoon now, it's obvious fog's not going to raise, and you're not going to see, so you might as well head on back to camp.
This guy is simply a master storyteller. I'd love to keep going, but we've reached the end of our allotted time. But don't despair, we have another full episode of Ken Fanning next week. Join us then for more of Alaska Tracks.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.